Welcome to Simple Living Works, episode 65. I'm Jerry Iverson. It's my pleasure to be your host with my guest, Ken Sehested, founding executive director of the Baptist Peace Fellowship in North America, author and blogger. If you're new to this podcast and would like more basic information about Simple Living Works, please listen clear to the end. If you're a regular, you may want to say goodbye at my cue after the interview. In his own words, Ken Sehested is the editor, author of the online journal Prayer and Politics. Once upon a time, he played football at Baylor University, and he was a traveling teenage youth evangelist. No longer a teenager, he is still an evangelist, though his understanding of what that means to follow Jesus has changed considerably. Ken's closest brush with jobs people would understand were as a typesetter and later as a stonemason. Being picky about your work means creating your own. As a full-time mendicant with Seeds magazine in 1978, when it became a monthly magazine focusing on food security and world hunger concerns, then as the founding director of the Baptist Peace Fellowship of North America in 1984, as founding co-pastor of Circle of Mercy Congregation in Asheville, North Carolina in 2001, and now as the Electronic Ink Slinger. An award-winning activist and author, Ken's greater honor came when a four-year-old granddaughter memorized and recited his favorite Mary Oliver poem as a Father's Day gift. His most recent books are Peace Primer 2, quotes from Jewish, Christian, and Islamic scripture and tradition, and two collections of litanies, prayers, and poems, In the Land of the Living and In the Land of the Willing. He and Nancy live in the French Broad watershed of the Southern Appalachian Mountains in Asheville, North Carolina. Today we'll be talking about, of course, your work and your writings, but also the intersection between the peace movement and the voluntary simplicity movement. Mm-hmm. So first of all, you told me an interesting story that way back in your seminary days in the 70s, you had actually worked with Bob Kaczynski, the founder of Alternatives, and helped to prepare some Thanksgiving resources. And
that's
from
correct.
And from there, you've done a lot of other compilations. And give us a little bit of your history. I find it a fascinating story. And we'll talk about the Baptist Peace Fellowship.
Well, I was raised in a very traditional Southern Baptist revivalist religious culture that began to fall apart when I was in high school and then early college days. I actually fled the South and transferred to New York University, where my theological world really kind of came apart and then slowly rebuilt as I went to Union Seminary in New York, and discovered there this impulse that actually dates from my earlier years, that there was a profound vision that tied together a kind of beatific vision of the beloved community, the kingdom of God in traditional language, and the struggle for justice, peace, human rights, etc. I landed on that focus on world hunger issues early on, and in fact, by the way, I did find that packet in my files, which I'll send you, the alternative Thanksgiving packet. Out of seminary, my wife and I moved to Atlanta and joined a congregation that we knew there, where two men my age, recently graduates, were working on a simple little newsletter called Seeds Magazine. And the three of us continued that for a time and then made the bold decision to turn it into a monthly publication. So that was the start of my organizing career, which has been my career for most of my life, until my wife and I and another friend founded a new congregation here in Asheville, North Carolina in 2001. Last year, I relinquished my pastoral duties to take up and publish an online journal called Prayer and Politics, and that's my principal occupation these days.
It seems to me that the reputation of Baptists is not necessarily that of being peace churches. And having read your statement about founding the Baptist Peace Fellowship, it sounds like herding cats.
It is. We have, when people refer to the larger Baptist family, it's hard to know if it's a sometimes you think it's a three-ring circus more than a big tent. But, you know, as part of the origins of the Baptist movement have clear roots in the Continental Anabaptist movement of the 15th and 16th centuries, where there was a very clear theological declaration rather than political declaration, refusal to wield the sword in defense of the state. And so I discovered my deep Anabaptist roots while in seminary, as well as 18th and 19th century abolitionists and suffragettes within Baptist and his so-called evangelical circles. There is a history there within Baptist life, though it may be a thin history.
Well, I know as a Lutheran that there are all sorts of flavors of Lutherans, and there are all sorts of flavors
right.
of Baptists as well. I mean, we think of the Southern Baptists as being fundamentalists, and we think of the American Baptists as being moderates or even progressives. And I would assume mm-hmm. that you have more appeal to the moderates and the progressives in the Baptist Church, but correct me if I'm wrong.
No, that's correct. Clearly that's true. And it's been a staple of my work, both doing world hunger and food security issues, and then with the Baptist Peace Fellowship. Though we understood when the Baptist Peace Fellowship was founded, it was very clear that if Baptists had saints, Martin Luther King Jr. would be the patron saint of our organization, precisely because of the way he understood the connection between domestic oppression and international aggression. In my work, I've always been less interested in what you are against, i.e. war, than what you are for. And that always includes the work of justice. In fact, if you could quantify the work of the Baptist Peace Fellowship somehow, I'm guessing that the struggle against racism was probably our top number one priority in terms of the assets, staff time, and budget that we use. But we understood there was a profound connection in all these things, including, you know, starting in very personal terms with the commitment to simple living as a way to de-escalate, remove ourselves from the typical treadmill of consumerism. So it was a clear understanding that was part of the larger struggle as well.
Just to clarify something, Martin Luther King Jr. was, and indeed, if I'm correct, an ordained Baptist minister.
That's right, yeah.
Now, I noticed that on the Baptist Peace Fellowship of North America website, you use the initials, but then you use the Spanish version, Bautistas por la Paz. And
that's
it
right.
seems to me that you're really being a global organization.
Well, not quite. When the Peace Fellowship was founded in 1984, we actually drew together constituencies from American Baptist churches and a group of students at Southern Seminary in Louisville who published Baptist Peacemaker. So we wanted to create a bridge between those two constituencies, but not just those, but from other Baptist bodies as well. And in fact, we knew the danger of having only a institution with based solely in the U.S. And so from the beginning, we saw ourselves as an organization with membership and board members from Canada, the U.S., Puerto Rico, and Mexico. And that's why the Of North America on there, commitment to create within our own structure some critical assessment of the kind of hubris. If you're raised in the U.S., there is a kind of hubris that's just in the water and in the air. You can't help but sensing. So from the very beginning, we had we didn't want to declare ourselves the Global Baptist Peace Fellowship, which is another form of arrogance, kind of like the World Series has teams from two countries. But more recently, the change a couple of years ago that the Baptist Peace Fellowship staff and directors made was to intentionally use that phrase, Spanish phrase, to emphasize the trans-American or trans-U.S. Reality of the organization.
I noticed that you're having a conference in Colombia coming up in a couple of years. Is the mm-hmm. Baptist Peace Fellowship of North America associated with a global Baptist Peace Fellowship?
There is such a reality, though it's entirely informal. This series of international conferences that we've had actually dates back to 1988. When we convinced the European Baptist Federation to co-sponsor the first ever in history peace conference that focused on justice and peace issues. That was followed by a subsequent conference with the Nicaraguan Baptist Convention in 92. And then in 96, we helped our friends in Asia do an event just for Asian nations. In 2000, our friends in Melbourne, Australia, co-sponsored a global meeting there in January of 2000. Most recently, in 2009, the Italian Baptist Union co-sponsored with us a global Baptist Peace Conference. And so this upcoming conference in January of 2018 is a follow-up of that series. We discovered very early on in our organizing that there are Baptist-flavored folk from around the world who though despite very distinct contexts, struggle with some of the very same social, political, and theological issues that we do here in the U.S. And so, we have discovered that we have brothers and sisters all over the place, aunts, uncles, cousins, finding those folk and encouraging and nourishing those with peacemaking convictions is kind of the heart of the vision of organizing.
I noticed that the Baptist Peacemaker, which you spoke of a minute ago, is still alive and well and is edited by Katie Cook from Texas. Katie
Correct.
And I have worked together on mm-hmm. Some projects, most recently a collection called Worship Alternatives. She was the editor of Seeds that you also mentioned earlier, and she's a fascinating
exactly.
person in that she is not only a Baptist, but she's a member. She's a member of the lay order of Franciscans.
Yep, that's correct.
And the Franciscans are close to known as peacemakers.
Yeah, you will find back to your earlier thought about the connection between Simple Living Movement and the work for justice or for peace, you will find frequent crossovers, particularly with folk who understand the holistic nature of transformation that's needed. Getting saved in traditional Baptist language is always personal, but it's never private. There's always a connection between personal change and public change. Though the strategies one employs to accomplish those goals may be different, the theory is whole. The change infects every part of the system.
What I've noticed in some peace groups is they like to get together and talk, and then they try to radiate peace in their personal lives, which is good. That's an important start. They're reluctant, however, to take the step of group action.
That's right.
Demonstrations and letter writing campaigns, putting their name on the line. How have you found that to be in the Baptist Peace Fellowship?
Well, there is in American intellectual history, theological history generally, and maybe more pronounced in the evangelical, so-called evangelical wing of that tradition, a personalism which often obscures the way we are tied structurally and systematically to structures of injustice and oppression. And understanding and learning how to affect systemic change and structural change has always been a part of the vision, not segregated from personal efforts, but understanding that these things are of a whole. Some constituencies will emphasize more one than the other, and that's fine because we are all individual human beings and have different personalities. But keeping those constituencies together in a common conversation is always urgent, instead of debating over which is more important, personal or public change. That's kind of like asking which came first, the chicken or the egg. That's just a philosophical sinkhole. We all began at one place or another. The point is not to just remain in place, but complete the cycle, understanding change in a very holistic way. And our goal is always, I was reminded recently of a great quote from Pete Seeger, who said, I'd much rather prefer putting a song on people's lips than merely in their ears. That's one of the great failings of justice and peace movements, is we tend to focus only on the ears of our constituency and spend little time actually helping them mobilize and incarnate activities that will lead towards what in Jewish Talmud is spoken of as tikkun olam, the healing of the world.
Very good. Well, let's talk about some of those specific programs of the Baptist Peace Fellowship. For example, Peace Camp. Tell us about that and some of the other programs. My wife and I are very active in the fair trade movement, for example. I noticed the Baptist Peace Fellowship has a fair trade project.
That's right, yeah. Peace Camp, as it's popularly known, the summer conference was one of the first initiatives we took probably in the second year of our life. So back since 1986, there has been a summer gathering. For many years, it was actually built. The phrase was part conference, part revival. We attempted to incorporate the strength of the revivalist movement, which is a bringing of the entire body and not just the cognitive function of being a human being into what it meant to be a disciple. And so it's really developed a reputation and a tradition of a profoundly encouraging experience for 5 days. In fact, we set off from the beginning trying to make this one of our highest goals was that it be a family-friendly event, and we were successful almost beyond imagination. In fact, it became quite a logistical difficulty dealing with the sheer number of children that we had coming to these events. We had to really rethink what these events were and how we organize resources because our children's program was quite popular. And, you know, things like fair trade has been an ongoing emphasis for a number of years. There was a project which was especially near and dear to my heart called the Gleaners Project, where we encourage people to shift at least a portion of their personal savings or retirement incomes or for a local church, their savings or a rainy day fund into community investing. Shifting working capital into places where it was most needed. That was something that, in fact, I still work on. I'm no longer working for the Baptist Peace Fellowship, but doing alternative investing advocacy is one of my passions.
Let's talk about some of your other work, Ken. For example, you put out in 2002 the Peace Primer, and then more recently, Peace Primer 2, which is an updated and expanded version of that. What's interesting to me about that is that in the latest version, you've worked with an Islamic editor, writer, leader, and a Jewish leader as well. So it's an interfaith approach. They all are the three, you know, best known of the Abrahamic faiths. Tell us about that, and then also tell us whether you see a vision of expanding to include other world religions, for example, Hindus or Buddhists.
Yeah, the Peace Primer actually dates back to 2001 after the trauma of September 11th. We, along with everyone else, trying to figure out how can we respond creatively to this devastation. As it happens, because of my our organization's association with the Fellowship of Reconciliation, the largest interfaith organization in the U.S., I had met Rabbi Terry Harris, the founder of the Muslim Peace Fellowship. And so, really on a lark, I called Rabbi and said, what could we get key leaders in our organizations together for a day or so to talk about this tragedy and what we might do cooperatively that would signal good things, that would be good news. And we thought, you know, just from a public relations standpoint, you know, Baptists and Muslims working together would probably interest media, you know, just because of the unique partnership that would create. So we did meet. We spent a day in Detroit with our key leaders and decided on two concrete projects. The most immediate one that we could do was Rabbi and I said that we would collect texts from Jewish and Muslim scripture and tradition and publish it in a booklet form, really as a tool for local organizers in Christian and Islamic communities could use this to begin a conversation on a local level, just to review each other's statements about justice and peacemaking and human rights. And that was wildly successful. The other thing that we did was agreed to do some conflict transformation training, and we held several trainings in Detroit following that initial meeting that we had. Later, then three years ago now, we had from the beginning thought about making this a larger project, we decided at the very beginning it's better to do something small than nothing at all. So we did one with a Christian and Islamic scripture and tradition. But through both of our friendships with a Jewish rabbi, we decided to expand this initial offering to include, as you mentioned, the three principal Abrahamic faith traditions, and that document, that book, has gone through multiple printings. We found out 2 years ago that a Lutheran church in Abbottabad, Pakistan, used the Peace Primer to do an interfaith consultation with women, Muslim and Christian women, in the city there in Pakistan, where it's been in the news because that's where Osama bin Laden was killed. So it's had some impact around the world as well as here in the U.S. and in North America. Interfaith peacemaking is, you know, undermining theological justification for war is maybe our most pressing interfaith peacemaking task. In terms of whether we will eventually expand it to for constituencies on a broader interfaith basis, We don't have any plans in the immediate future to do that, but I think that's always an option.
And I'll mention quickly that that book, Peace Primer 2, is available free of charge as a PDF download, and I'll include a link to that in the show notes for this episode. Well, let's talk about your other two books, Ken, Land of the Living and Land of the Willing. I understand that these two have come out primarily from your writings there at your church. And then we want to quickly go on, of course, to talk about your blog, Prayer and Politics, and its related newsletter.
Signs of the Times, right. Yeah, the as a pastor, my theological vision has always taken worship very, very seriously, because you know the root word of worship means worthy. I believe in worship is where we clarify what things are worthy and where our allegiances lie. It's where our imaginations are trained. And as one philosopher once said, if you want to change people's obedience, you must first change their imagination. To get them convinced that another world is not only possible, but in fact is on its way to us. And so as a worship planner, almost every week I would write an original call to worship, usually inspired by one of the lectionary texts. And it's a poetic way to imagine our vocation as healers in the world and our calling as disciples, as living into the Beatitudes for the coming reign of God. And so out of that writing, I received encouragement from people passing through visiting with us and said, you know, we need this material out there in churches. And so eventually I put together a short book with a collection of those, and then a few years later published a second book with additional ones. Most of those are actually on my online journal in one section of litanies, as well as other poetry. But that continues to be writing poetry as I was a latecomer. Primarily an activist for most of my life, discovered in the mid-90s, finally gave voice to some instincts to write poetry, and it's now more of a central preoccupation than is activism.
Thank you, Ken. I will put links to those to your newsletter, Signs of the Times and Prayer and Politics, in the show notes. But I want to call people's attention to the fact that your newsletter is arranged like sort of like a worship service. You know, it has a call to worship and it has a sermon, but no one should be put off by that, because it's just packed full of links to articles that are relevant to the peace movement.
Mm-hmm. And music. Each week's column is structured somewhat like a liturgy, with a starting with a processional and ending with a recessional, with a lot of the standard stops that you would experience in a liturgical worship service, with short quotes, bits of information, links to and not just religious, explicitly religious music, but a range of music that is not explicitly religious. And probably the principal audience, when I sit down to compile that, I think probably principally working pastors, people who were perpetual preparers, who were always looking for material. New material, fresh material, useful, helpful material in preparing sermons or Sunday school lessons or just to speak intelligently about the intersection of our faith and the world in which we live, to give some useful background information on some overlooked news or some particularly prescient quotes, and usually some material related to lectionary, you know, some litanies, poetry or articles that are especially helpful. So it's thinking, my goal is to make it a quick read, easy to sit down and stop and start in any number of places in any given weekly column, and to provide people information that they can actually make use of.
Well, it's beautifully done, Ken.
Thank you.
In closing, I'd like you to maybe briefly just express some of the joys and frustrations of being a co-pastor of an authentic peace church. And you might also explain if that means being a pacifist church.
Yeah, our congregation a number of years ago intentionally set out on a long conversation, I think it took us nearly 18 months, to talk about whether or not we want to consider ourselves a peace church. It was a very fruitful conversation, and in the end, it was the statement that we adopted was adopted unanimously. The statement does not use the word pacifism. In fact, I have a very mixed emotions about the use of the term, and don't typically use it myself, partly because, as I mentioned earlier, pacifism tends to say what you're against rather than what you are for. Pacifism sounds in English an awful lot like passivity, and in fact, probably the major stream of interpretation of pacifism is passivity, withdrawal from the world. Partly, though, because of humility. I don't know that any of us, short of a genuine life-threatening situation, know what we would do if faced within that circumstance. So it's a kind of humility to not use that term. If people directly ask me, are you a pacifist, my response is, I'm willing to be tested. I think there is an inherent commitment in Christian confession to explore the nonviolence of God as a pattern of living and not just of thinking, and that is the central mandate of Jesus was to love enemies. Scholars now recognize that was the center of his message. And figuring out ways to do that is not at all easy. It's often very, very complex. The answers are rarely simple and straightforward. But it requires a community to keep asking these questions, keep experimenting, finding small and incremental ways to practice nonviolence rather than just some large public expression. But, you know, one of the things that Baptist Peace Fellowship did in the mid-90s was help create the Family Covenant of Nonviolence, which was helping parents learn to rear children in ways that teach them habits, behaviors and habits of how to respond to conflict without picking up a stick. Again, there's this holistic principle and process of developing nonviolent habits. So our congregation continues to be a wellspring of inspiration. Right now we've got a very active group working on sanctuary movement, the Immigration Customs Enforcement Agency is moving in our agents in our region, picking up people who don't have legal documentation for exporting. And so one of our newest mission groups is working on providing some level of safety to immigrants, undocumented immigrants here in Asheville. We have a very active Cuba partnership. U.S.-Cuba affairs have been one of my longest-standing passion. we are a congregation like any other in that we're a collection of flawed people, the same struggles that you have in any institution, organization we have in our own midst. So there's nothing, I wouldn't want to paint an idealistic picture that we're all happy together all the time. We have our own struggles, but it's an invigorating place to be. One of our members mentioned in a Lenten study group last year, we're talking about the nature and character of what the church should be, and he used the phrase, the church is a community of consequence. And I love that phrase and use that frequently. This is a holy week world in which we live. I can't think of a time when the political prospects seem bleaker, both internally and externally, domestically and internationally. This is a time for people of faith to dig deep and discover if we still have resilient roots of hope that we can continue to live out of in the midst of the crazy times in which we live.
Indeed. Peace, brother. Be in touch.
Thank you.
And be well. Bye-bye now.
Right. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to my conversation with author, blogger, and peace organizer Ken Sehested. You're welcome to share your thoughts on these subjects. Email a message to simplelivingworks@yahoo.com. on our Facebook page, or on the Simple Living Works blog. Those addresses are given in the show notes and on our website, simplelivingworks.org. Click in window number 3. I received a wonderful birthday tribute on Facebook from my lovely daughter-in-law, Angela. She said, "Happy birthday, Gerald. You're a wonderful father-in-law and grandpa. You inspire me to think and live simply, and I thank you for all you've done for me and our family. Love you." Love you too, Angela. Yes, it's great to be 68. I'm looking forward in the near future to a follow-up conversation with Peter Sautel of Echo Justice Ministries. Time to wrap up this episode of Simple Living Works podcast. If you're new to Simple Living Works and would like more basic information about the organization, please listen a little longer. If you're a regular, you may want to say goodbye here. Peace. If you haven't subscribed yet, we hope you will now through iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast service. Remember that you can listen to all episodes of Simple Living Works podcast. They're archived twice. Access them at simplelivingworks.org, window number 3. Click Preview, Backup, and choose the episodes you want with or without show notes. Subscriptions to this podcast and to our weekly blog are free, and they keep you current automatically when we post something new. Urge your friends to do the same. Remember to like us on Facebook. You can also subscribe in iTunes to my other podcast, The Common Good Podcast, which I produce and co-host with Jubilee One Earth Economics. We do not accept or solicit donations, nor do we sell anything. All our resources and services are free of charge. We're an all-volunteer organization. Send us your email address to receive the free monthly Simple Living Works e-news. Thanks to the band Earth Mama and to John Pitney for the music on our show. This podcast is covered by the Creative Commons Non-Commercial Attribution Share-Alike license. To learn more about Creative Commons, click on its link on our website homepage. We at Simple Living Works believe that simple living really does work. Voluntary simplicity, choosing to live simpler lives, is a faithful, satisfying, effective, comprehensive lifestyle. It's not a list of rules nor living on the cheap. It avoids fads, convenience, and deprivation. It's so much more than a hobby. We believe in abundance, that there's enough for everyone's needs, not anybody's greed. We follow the saying, "Live simply that others may simply live," as our closing theme song proclaims. It's a balance of personal responsibility and advocacy for just public policy. It's more than personal happiness, though that's quite important. Contemporary faith-based simple living is guided by the 5 life standards of Living More with Less, the classic by Doris Jansen Longacre, and I've discussed these standards in earlier episodes. The mission of Simple Living Works is equipping people of faith to challenge consumerism, live justly, and celebrate responsibly. We extend the mission and resources of the nonprofit organization, which served from 1973 to 2011. The three parts of our mission are elaborated in text and video. Links are listed in the show notes. We produce a half-hour podcast twice a month, hopefully educational and inspiring for you, your family, and your congregation or group. Until next time, this is Jerry Iverson of Simple Living Works podcast, wishing you well as we strive to challenge consumerism, live justly, and celebrate responsibly.
Mm-hmm. Learn to live simply so others can simply live. Learn to live simply so others can simply live. Learn to live simply so others can simply live. Learn to live simply so others can live.